Gresham College presents Confronting the Terrorist Mind, Explaining the Repeated Failure of Intelligence by Dr. Raj Prasad.
I want to talk a little bit about how psychology should be applied to modern politics and conflict, and would help us if that happened. And I want to start off in a slightly strange way by talking a bit about the card game poker. Now, I'm honestly not looking for an excuse to talk about poker, though many of you will know that I enjoy playing the game. But poker is a game of bluff, deception, aggression, and manipulation. And as a result, it's a game of strategy, which, like chess, has attracted military tacticians as modeling some of the skills needed in warfare. Poker is actually closer to the real world of conflict and strategy in war than chess, because in chess, all the pieces are on the board for all to see. So there is no uncertainty about what is going on. And also, there's no possibility of deception or bluff. In poker, the hand of cards you hold and its strength or weakness may be something your opponent never sees at all. Because if you bet aggressively enough and force them to fold their hand, you take the pot without ever having to reveal what you actually held. In real warfare, there is uncertainty about what your enemy is up to and their actual resources or capabilities. And many of the moves and countermoves in the strategy of politics and war are about outfoxing your opponent. Many world and military leaders are said to have honed their skills at political and military tactics first at the poker table, including Nixon, Truman, Eisenhower, and General Patton. Poker is an excellent way of demonstrating one of the most important psychological concepts in human conflict, referred to as theory of mind. Theory of mind is all about the idea that I have to take a good guess at what is going on in your mind in order to communicate with you, persuade you, or outwit you. This is called second order theory of mind. First order... First order theory of mind being having some idea of what is going on in your own mind. Whatever you do, don't take first order theory of mind for granted. It's surprisingly absent in a large number of our fellow citizens. Third order theory of mind is a vital step all great military and political tacticians take, but few others do. It's not just me thinking about what you're thinking, but going one step further and working out what you're thinking about what I'm thinking. Let me illustrate this with a famous story from poker. It's a true story and comes from the gold rush in San Francisco of the 19th century, when prospectors, having mined their gold nuggets, would get the slow boat to New York, where they would eventually cash in their bullion. But the only way to while away the time away on the slow boat was, of course, to play poker on the deck with their nuggets. One day, a group of prospectors are sitting on the deck playing poker when the pot in the middle with their bets has grown to enormous proportions, and a small fortune is waiting to be won. Then the last card gets dealt to each player. But before one prospector can take hold of his card, he catches a brief glimpse of it, but a gust of wind promptly blows the card overboard. He unhesitatingly dives into the sea to retrieve the card and is nearly drowned in the attempt. He is dragged back onto the deck by his fellow card players, clutching the damp card fervently to his chest. He makes a big bet. All the other players reason he must have a great card because he was willing to drown to get it back. And so they all fold, leaving him the huge pot. He was, of course, bluffing. He had nothing. He was, however, demonstrating very effectively third-order theory of mind. He worked out what they would think he was thinking from his actions. I mention third-order theory of mind because it's this tool which we need to understand the mind of a terrorist. Not just what they're thinking, but what they're thinking about what we're thinking. It's this level that our leaders and our media never seem to get to when they engage with the issue of terrorism. It is third-order theory of mind which helps us understand what is really going on here and which unlocks the true answer to this rapidly growing and frightening problem. This past January, a young Palestinian mother, feigning a limp and requesting medical help, blew herself up at a security checkpoint leading from the Gaza Strip into Israel. The attack killed four Israeli security personnel, along with the Hamas bomber herself, who left behind a three-year-old son and a one-year-old daughter. The Israeli Defense Forces automatically shut down the industrial zone, sending home the 5,000 Palestinians employed in its factories. Within hours, a general closure was enacted, barring some 20,000 Gazan commuters from working in Israel. With 60% of Palestinians living on less than $2 a day, one could question whom the attack hurt more, the Israelis or the Palestinians themselves. Why then do terrorist groups engage in such apparently self-defeating behavior? One obvious theory is that terrorism is a product of a non-rational, disturbed, or psychotic mind. This appears to be our leaders' and the media's favorite theory, that the terrorist mind is beyond comprehension or understanding. This theory receives some support when you look into the psychology of people like Timothy McVeigh, who blew up the government building in Oklahoma in 1995, killing approaching 200 people, 19 of them children, as part of the building was a daycare center for children of government employees. McVeigh had bombed the building in revenge for the Waco raid by the FBI, in which cult leader David Koresh and 80 of his followers were incinerated, a siege that photographic evidence was later to show McVeigh had visited. The Oklahoma bombing occurred on the anniversary of the Waco raid. McVeigh thought the army had implanted a computer chip in his buttock to track his movements. He apparently subscribed to the notion that the back of road signs have barcode stickers to assist UN troops in their takeover of the USA, and therefore citizens needed to arm themselves to protect their rights in the face of their own government. When detained by a police officer, McVeigh was driving a vehicle with no license plate, the hallmark of some extremist US groups that are anti-tax. There is little doubt that McVeigh was suffering from such a severe disturbance of mind that he might well be labeled formally mentally ill. Yet terrorism of the most lethal type, as in September the 11th, is mostly a group activity, and therefore ideas and forms of thinking are shared between group members, which normally precludes the kind of severe mental illness that McVeigh probably suffered from, and which explains why he acted largely alone. Most severely mentally ill people become very precisely because their beliefs are so strange, caused as they probably are by disturbed brain biochemistry, that no one else can comprehend them or dialogue with them. The larger the group involved in terrorist activity, the less likely there is to be medically abnormal states of mind supporting this venture. In a widely read account of Palestinian martyrs published shortly after 9/11 in The New Yorker, Nasra Hassan observed that none of the 250 or so suicide bombers and their handlers that she interviewed conformed to the typical suicidal or disturbed personality. None of them were uneducated, desperately poor, simple-minded, or depressed. Many were middle class, and unless they were fugitives, held paying jobs. Among them, in fact, were the sons of two millionaires. Oddly enough, there is indeed evidence that terrorists do suffer from quite profound psychological dysfunction, but intriguingly, these tend to be Western terrorists brought up and living in Western liberal democracies, like Timothy McVeigh. In contrast, terrorism bred from other parts of the world, far from Western liberal democracy, like the Palestinian and the Tamil scenarios, seems to be promulgated by those who appear entirely sane in the medical sense. Crucially, they're drawn from a larger community which supports the actions of terrorists. Two of the societies that have produced the highest number of the most extreme form of terrorism, suicide bombers, the Tamils and the Palestinians, repeatedly are found in surveys to house large majorities who support terrorist activity. So the strategy cannot be legitimately described as arising out of individual, abnormal experience or psychology. Furthermore, these communities see terrorism as serving their interests. In other words, their view is that this is an entirely rational course of action to take. Recent polls show that up to 70% of the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza support suicide bombing, up from the 26% of the population that agreed with it in 1999. This is a remarkable change. In addition, there is the immense popularity of the name Osama amongst newborns in Pakistan immediately after September the 11th. Nigerians in the largely Muslim city of Kano name 7 out of 10 boys Osama. To explain terrorism, you have to account for why millions of people in some parts of the world endorse this extraordinary use of violence against unarmed combatants. Many years ago, in a letter to Freud, Einstein asked, "Why war?" Freud responded in a 30-page letter, which may be boiled down to a basic assertion. He posited that human beings are endowed by nature with hostile, violent feelings that, like water in a reservoir, start to build up over time. Although initially blocked by the restraints of civilization, the hostility eventually breaks through, leading to a grand catharsis, namely war. According to this theory, equilibrium is then restored, and the individual and society as a whole can continue to function. Freud saw this catharsis as a good thing, because he assumed it was necessary for the human race to have a periodic bloodbath in order to be able to maintain its sanity. Against the Freudian view that we are all deep down homicidal maniacs, just waiting to be wound up and let loose to cause wanton destruction, is the opposing evidence that actually the vast majority of us suffer from strong compunctions against violence. For example, it was discovered as recently as the 1950s that many American soldiers were not firing their guns during the Korean War. When their rifles were examined, only about 20% of the guns showed any use of ammunition. Other shells were still in the gun. This was very disturbing to the military. Consequently, during the Vietnam War, they conditioned the trainees to killing by training them to shoot repeatedly at targets of the enemy. They went through many exercises of shooting these targets until it became second nature, like a reflex. The repeated practice bypassed their natural inhibitions against killing. This kind of conditioning could have contributed to slayings that took place in Vietnamese villages where the soldiers simply ran amok. That inner inhibition against killing had been removed. The terrifying point here is that many ordinary people in the right circumstances can be surprisingly influenced, given the right conditions and techniques, into violence, though they may not have been violent to begin with. But given the huge psychological and material cost of conflict, in personal and group terms, we need to go back to the central question, which is why does violent conflict occur in the first place? In comparison to humans, whose history is dominated by warfare, there is relatively little violent conflict between animals of the same species, because animals first dispassionately assess how likely victory is and invariably opt to withdraw in the face of a superior adversary. There is indeed evolutionary pressure for all animals to accurately assess when it is not worth fighting. The widespread use of threat rituals in anticipation of combat amongst animals usually determines who is the superior party and so prevents numerous actual fights. It naturally follows that the human tendency to war becomes an evolutionary puzzle. After all, humans frequently go to war when any rational assessment should have indicated a low probability of victory or little advantage to fighting for at least one side. Inaccurate prior battle assessment of your enemy results in more damage and lower chances of future survival than if a more judicious withdrawal had been selected. The answer is, it seems, that the universal human tendency to suffer from positive self-illusions not only starts many wars, but also increases the chances of successfully bluffing the enemy into believing he's unlikely to win. And so it also increases the unpredictability of battles. In human conflict, it is surprisingly often the weaker side which wins through the use of deception and manipulation. Sure enough, Bush and Blair have announced a war on terror based on the unstated presumption that we can win such a war. Is this yet another positive illusion? Video images of our precision weapons and the invocation of shock and awe as Baghdad was pounded, invoke a sense of safety and superiority in us, Surely it's the terrorists who are mad for even thinking of taking on the might of the US and the UK military. After all, the US spends as much as the rest of the world put together on arms. At this level, the terrorist temerity in taking on the West does indeed seem crazy. If both sides make an assessment as to the likelihood of victory, and one side has enormous superiority in terms of conventional weapons, a crucial question becomes, what is influencing the assessment of the weaker side that still decides to embrace conflict? They are clearly not just looking at the strength of their opponents. They must be seeing something that we are not considering. What are they thinking about which we are not taking into consideration? What is the third order theory of mind here? Yes, they're doing excellent third order theory of mind. They see something which our leaders would rather we ourselves don't allow for, which is that, yes, we have colossal strength, but also we harbor massive vulnerability. Our vulnerability is not to a conventional attack, but instead to an unconventional one, precisely indeed a terrorist one. And this is because we live in complex, intricate, densely populated cities which are enormously vulnerable to terrorist assault and also chaos from akin strategies, including false alarms. Our leaders want us to believe that what we are up against are deranged madmen because this comforts us into thinking that our intellectual and physical superiority guarantee us eventual victory. If we instead conceive of terrorists as highly intelligent, clear-thinking, and deeply committed to our destruction, then other deeply terrifying possibilities begin to take shape, which our leaders don't want us to consider. Imagine a kind of ultimate weapon, a bomb which possesses an onboard computerized processing unit of such advanced capability that it has its own kind of independent decision-making ability, so that although typically launched against pre-designated targets, the bomb is able to provide real-time course corrections on the way to its objective, varying the timing, the circumstances, and sometimes the specific target of attack to improve its chances of success. I have some grave news for you. We don't yet have such a weapon. But our enemy does. It's called a suicide bomber. Individuals carrying out such attacks can be thought of as a low-tech smart bomb with a human guidance system. Like their high-tech counterparts, they offer a greater probability of engaging and destroying their targets. The cost-effectiveness of suicide bombing is indeed impressive. The total cost of a typical Palestinian suicide operation is about $150. This modest sum yields a grimly attractive return. On average, suicide operations worldwide kill about 4 times as many individuals as other kinds of terrorist attacks. In Israel, the average is even higher, inflicting 6 times the number of deaths and roughly 26 times more casualties than other acts of terrorism. But a key element of the tactic which is overlooked by Bush and Blair is that popular acceptance of suicide tactics is clearly an essential prerequisite if a group expects to advance its position by killing off its membership and still find the follow-on volunteers needed to sustain its campaign over time. Suicide attacks even prove to be a source of unity between the terrorist group and its political constituents. The death of a martyr is presented as a collective loss, not only for the organization with which he was affiliated, but the community from which he volunteered. Honoring his memory requires honoring the cause he chose to die for, a psychological response that further binds his survivors to the group. Palestinian groups, for example, now regularly videotape the last testaments of those who are about to die to distribute after their deaths. These tapes are specifically designed to evoke a sense of pride and reciprocal obligation on the part of their viewing audience. The tapes typically show the then living martyr standing tall, wearing his suicide vest, holding a copy of the Quran and a Kalashnikov, calling on those he leaves behind to join him in paradise. Hanging in the background as a brand identifier for those who wish to sign on next is the flag or banner of the group that sent him on his way. The heroic and selfless character of the martyr's sacrifice is the subject of sermons and discussions in local mosques. When news of a successful suicide strike is broadcast, candy is typically distributed in the streets, and women respond with traditional cries of joy. Martyrdom has become an ambition for our children, Sadl Abu Hain, a psychology lecturer from Gaza, observed. But the attraction of suicide terrorism is due not only to their average number of casualties, but that the tactic itself is newsworthy in its own right. A terrorist action is ultimately a publicity stunt designed to gain the highest possible media exposure. So equally significant is the inherent drama of the attack itself. Those killed do not die by chance. They are chosen for their innocence. The bomber selects his targets, walks among them, looks into their faces, and detonates his bomb. The choreographed brutality of the act commands attention. Essentially, there are always two targets in the mind of a terrorist. One might well be the immediate unfortunate victims who bear the brunt of an explosion, but this is only a minor dimension of the actual but more clandestine aim. The second, but indeed primary target of any terrorist incident, is the psyche of the population. The mind is the key battleground where this new and peculiarly 21st century conflict is being fought. And one key question is, are we winning that battle of the mind? This is because the key effect of a terrorist incident is not the atrocity itself, but instead the way it affects everyone else who weren't even directly involved. Here's an example of this effect. Professor Gerd Gergenizer, an expert on the psychology of risk at the Max Planck Institute for Human Development in Berlin, has published a new study into how travel behavior of Americans changed in the months following the September 11 attacks. Domestic air passenger miles fell roughly 16% in the final quarter. Americans dramatically switched from flying to using the roads in an effort to avoid the risk of being taken hostage by terrorists on planes sent crashing into buildings. But Gegenreiser demonstrates that as a direct result, there was a significant increase in the number of car fatal crashes in the last 3 months of 2001 compared with the same period in the year before the attacks. Because of the extra road traffic, 353 more people died in traffic accidents than would otherwise have done before the end of 2001. This represents a rise of fatal car accidents of 8%. This number of lost lives is an estimate of the price Americans paid for trying to avoid the risk of flying. It is perhaps particularly sobering to consider that the risk the millions of Americans were trying to avoid in not flying and driving instead was that of the fate suffered by 266 passengers and crew members on board the four flights that crashed. In other words, more people died in trying to avoid the fate of becoming victims of terrorism than actually did flying on board the fateful planes. The point of all this accumulating data is to demonstrate that the community is profoundly affected at an emotional level by terrorist attacks. And these emotions of panic, fear, and depression in their turn produce behavior whose ripple effects spread outwards, causing more negative effects than could be envisaged simply by focusing on a terrorist act. Maybe the reason governments are reluctant to address the key issue, which is the effect of terrorism on our psyche, is because to do so would also necessarily involve examining the wider impact of terrorism, the cost in terms of extra security and disruption to a society. So let's look at how our contemporary leaders are dealing with the current threat and compare it with how authorities in the past cope with previous dangers. In the USA, on April the 18th, 1775, Patriot Paul Revere rode his horse on the famous midnight ride from Boston Harbor toward Lexington, warning local colonial leaders along the way that the British Army, the Redcoats, were coming. He urged them to take up arms to oppose their tyrannical rule. When the British arrived the next day, they were defeated at Concord by the colonial militia, and America's Revolutionary War had its auspicious beginning. Revere's warning was effective for four key reasons. One, he was known to be a highly credible communicator, both expert and trustworthy. Two, his alarm was focused on a specific anticipated event. Three, it was designed to motivate citizens to act. And four, it called for a concrete set of actions. This Paul Revere paradigm for successful dissemination of public alarms is supported by contemporary psychological research. To be optimally effective, such alarms should arouse only a moderate level of motivation. Too low doesn't energize action, and too high creates emotional overload and competing distracting behaviors. The alarms must be based on reliable evidence and presented clearly by trustworthy sources about specific dangers or threats that may be dealt with by taking some recommended action. All these basic, rather obvious principles have been systematically violated in the design and delivery of the first 7 terrorist alarms issued by the US government officials since 9/11 to warn the public of imminent terrorist dangers. Different communicators were alleged to have reliable information from credible sources about an imminent attack by terrorists somewhere, sometime soon, in the US or anywhere in the world against its offices or agencies. These alarms worked to create high levels of citizen fear, which over time morphed into generalized anxiety. There was no concrete action that citizens might take, other than to remain on alert and to keep their eyes open. The initial message was that whether emanating from the Attorney General or other authorities, got replayed endlessly by different media sources and elaborated by various expert commentators. The psychological situation worsened when cognitive emotional dissonance was induced by the administration's collateral message to go about your business as normal. How is that possible after having declared the nation is under potential terrorist threat and personal safety and security is about to be violated once again as it was on 9/11? The resulting sense of confusion spills over into feelings of helplessness and results in less than optimal information processing that would be essential to cope with terrorist attacks. But then there were none, not a single terrorist attack on American soil since September 11th. Where are the alleged thousands of terrorists inhabiting cells in the country? And where was the debriefing by authorities to explain why nothing happened? It was nowhere in sight or sound. The high alert and its high anxiety induction just silently evaporated until another month or two when the next call to alarm was sounded again and again. We know from the classic story of the boy who cried wolf that after only 3 false alarms, people ceased to take seriously the validity of previously credible messengers. After 7 no-consequence alarms, many Americans became desensitized to the need to be on high alert, yet still lead normal lives. But for some, it became normal to be anxiously dreading the worst, given the lesson of the first horrific attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon. And then the other problem was the numerous false alarms. And there's one real possibility to consider, which is that seeing the frenzy created by the first alarms, terrorists intentionally put out misinformation on channels they assume are being monitored by US intelligence. As the foul-mouthed comic Lenny Bruce might have said, the terrorists threw a lot of shit all over the place, and we thought it was bad shit, when it was just shit. That chatter, detected by our intelligence services, stirred up the desired national turmoil and wasted a lot of money in heightened security, without terrorists having to engage in any suicidal attacks. But maybe our government wants to induce a particularly emotional state from all these false alarms in order to exploit it. False alarms have worked to sustain a heightened sense of anxiety and confusion for several years. They reinforce a public willingness to spend huge sums on military defense and homeland security. The alarms also create a climate of hostility and danger that encourage moral disengagement in accepting restrictions on personal freedoms and ignoring human rights violations or mistreatment of civilian prisoners, as in Guantanamo Bay. The latest emergency preparedness information on the US website of the Department of Homeland Security informs the public of the easy steps to be taken in a worst-case scenario, a neighborhood nuclear blast. Step 1, take cover. Step 2, assess the situation. Step 3, limit your exposure to radiation. And there are other steps that make as little practical sense in terms of what any individual can do in a nuclear attack. For example, putting some distance between you and the blast will also help. How do you do an assessment of the situation when undercover? Doesn't being undercover also fix the distance from the blast to you? We deserve better from our leaders, and we need to make this demand of them. Security and preparedness are essential components in countering terrorism, but so are honesty, transparency, and accountability of our leaders in whom we must trust. Terrorism is not about war in any traditional sense of destroying the material resources of an enemy nation and taking over their country. Terrorism is about psychology. It is about taking strategic actions that incite terror and fright in civilian populations. Terrorism is about making ordinary people feel vulnerable, anxious, confused, uncertain, and helpless. Ultimately, when terrorism works, citizens feel hopeless and trust in their leaders to guarantee the fundamentals of existence. Safety and security is lost. Terrorism is about imagining the monster under our beds or lurking in dark closets, the faceless, omnipotent enemy who might be the friendly ice cream van, our neighbor, or some horrible creature of our imagination. It has no one place, time, space, or face. The power of terrorism lies precisely in its pervasive ambiguity, in its invasion of our minds. Reactions to feeling personally vulnerable vary considerably, from blindly obeying powerful leaders and to intense feelings of anger. Anger is one form of displaced emotion that arises from feeling helpless or vulnerable. Human nature seems to abhor feelings of personal weakness and uncertainty, seeking instead to ally one's identity to those manifesting strength with conviction. In these times, people want to support leaders who are bold, decisive, single-minded, even arrogant men of action. They want our leaders to identify the enemy, for them to give it a name, a face, and a location, so that they can channel their collective hatred and unleash the strength of the military on a readily winnable war against anything that can be identified as a foe. Many of us are willing to accept any identifiable figure as proxy for the elusive virtual terrorist enemy. While we prepare to save our bodies, we must not lose our minds. Our government is not getting the best scientific advice on how to construct terror alerts and how to think like terrorists in selecting probable targets for attack. High levels of sustained stress on its citizens can have a greater long-term destructive impact on a nation than the consequences of any single terrorist attack. Much psychological research reveals the ease with which ordinary people can be recruited to engage in harmful behaviors against their fellows. In one classic study by Stanley Milgram, the majority of ordinary American citizens who participated in it blindly obeyed an authority figure and administered what they believed were painful, even lethal shocks to a stranger. In another demonstration from Zimbardo's Berkeley Laboratory, normal college students recruited to role-play prison guards became their roles in a matter of days, behaving with escalating violence and sadism toward their prisoners, other college students. We know that a cult leader, Jim Jones, Reverend of San Francisco's People's Temple, was able to program his followers to commit suicide or to kill one another on his command. More than 900 American citizens did so in the jungles of Guyana. Research by John Steiner, an Auschwitz survivor, indicates that most Nazi concentration camp guards were ordinary men before and following their years of perpetrating evil. Many more examples could be used to illustrate reasons why we should not demonize terrorists as an alien breed. Instead, we should focus on a better understanding of the mind control tactics and strategies that might make even good people engage in evil deeds at some time in their lives, and that might recruit new generations of impoverished young people into lives of terrorism. The efforts of our military forces in tracking down and destroying the terrorist leaders has a collateral risk. It models revenge and retaliation at a national level that can become a stimulus for individual hostility toward innocent citizens. Research by Dane Archer shows that homicide rates increase dramatically following all wars, the same for victor or loser nations. Presumably because individuals learn to use violent means of conflict resolution as had been sanctioned by their national leaders. We cannot allow that transfer of hostility to develop because it fuels the cycle of violence started by the terrorists. Terrorists create terror, terror creates fear and anger create aggression, and aggression against citizens of different ethnicity or religion creates racism, and that in turn new forms of terrorism. Suicide tactics have been adopted by a growing number of terrorist organizations around the world because they are shocking, deadly, cost-effective, secure, and very difficult to stop. There are only two basic operational requirements that an organization must be able to satisfy to get into this game: a willingness to kill and a willingness to die. We must, individually and collectively, refuse to adopt the terrorist devaluing of human life. If we do not, and we yield to the quiet rage of hatred that their vile deeds have generated in most of us, then our desire to destroy them at all costs allies us more with the forces of evil than of good. We have seen the enemy. Do not allow it to become us. Thank you. I think we have some time to take some questions.
I noticed you didn't make any connection between religion and terrorism. And modern day terrorism seems to be pretty strongly linked to religion, although you did refer to the Tamils as well as the Palestinians. Surely that has a very strong driving force these days. I cannot remember a period in history where suicide bombers were used as they are today, and even the horrors of Nazism didn't produce suicide activities.
Again, it's an excellent question, and it's something in the terrorism research literature the academics are themselves in some controversy over. They're asking questions about the role of religion. It has to be said that a large number of suicide attacks are not primarily driven or run by people who are very religiously driven. It's undoubtedly the case that religion is often used as part of the recruiting element. And the notion of an afterlife where you're rewarded, a lot of people think may provide a kind of incentive for people to commit suicide through this kind of killing. The issue to me is a difficult one, because there's a lot of evidence that actually religion is very good for people psychologically, that at times of stress, religious people actually do better and are much less likely to go down with an emotional illness or a psychological dysfunction at times of stress, because religion has within it many excellent coping resources. The problem with religion, though, there is very good evidence, and I say this fully aware that I'm going to irritate a lot of religious people in the hall, there's very good evidence that religious people tend to be more prejudiced against people who don't have their religion. So there's more antagonism and prejudice against members of the out-group than members of the in-group. And that is the problem with religion. It leads to a them and us mentality, which doesn't seem to be helpful in terms of getting communities to live together. And what I think has been sorely lacking is religious leaders coming together and symbolically meeting, for example. I mean, you don't see that, really, and that's a sad indictment, I would say, of religious leadership, and a testament to the divisiveness, to some extent, of religion. So I hope that has addressed your question. There's a chap down here at the front.
You have just gone, really, from a theoretical discussion on terrorism into a political matter. And our problem has been, certainly in the United Kingdom, is that we have, you can call it, tried to deal with these matters on a false prospectus, that for one reason or the other, we have not been given the chance or taken the opportunity to discuss the matter, but really we are discussing non-realities such as war on terror, which intrinsically is a nonsense. And our problem then becomes a political one of how do we get back to reality, not only in the United Kingdom, but far more importantly in the United States. I think it's a very difficult question.
Yeah, I agree, and I think that it's an important point you're making. Again, at the risk of going on and on about Mr. Blair, which is tricky as a psychiatrist talking about leaders, but you see, a very interesting psychological thing happened before the war in Iraq, which is when the public and journalists attempted to engage in some kind of debate about this issue, about why we were going to war. What both Bush and Blair said is, we know stuff that we can't tell you, which explains why we're doing what we're doing. Okay, and which was a difficult one because the pretext was that they had to protect our security by not telling us this stuff. So it was very difficult to have a grown-up debate. We now discover that whatever stuff it was that they knew, it wasn't really very convincing stuff. And actually, if they had told us about that stuff, we would have been amazed that they were thinking of going to war on that prospectus. So part of the grown-up debate we need to have with our leaders is to get past this constant thing they bring up, which is we can't discuss this with you because we have information that you don't have. And I hope what the electorate might learn from this whole war in Iraq is to understand that that is not a helpful statement for our leaders to make anymore, and that really we need to have a grown-up debate. And really, we have to question at a fundamental level what intelligence it is they're supposed to have at any level, given what we now found out. A lot of people don't realize that when the Oklahoma bombing occurred in 1995 that Timothy McVeigh was convicted and then executed for, the FBI, within a few hours of that bombing, released statements indicating they had already identified the Islamic militant group responsible for that bombing. And a Palestinian was detained on a flight out of the US to Europe. And the news agencies reported that he had bomb wiring equipment on him. It turned out what he had was some video cables, okay? And it turned out this was not obviously an Islamic militant terrorist attack, it was a homegrown one. So constantly we see evidence that so-called intelligence really, they're very weak on this. And all these false alarms as well are a strong indication that they're very weak on intelligence. And we need to call them to account, I think, on that. Ooh, lots of questions now. Shall we start from that? I think we should have this lady, because we haven't had that. This chap, then that lady. How about that?
Talking about the failures, people talk about the failures of intelligence, and you've implied that. Surely we don't know that there have been failures.
Sorry, what do you mean by
we
that?
Can't know, can we? If intelligence has stopped outrages, which allegedly they have, we're not in a position to say that the intelligence has failed.
Again, it's an excellent point. However, we do, if I recall correctly, have a criminal justice system, which means that if people have been arrested legitimately for planning terrorist incidents and there's good evidence, these people should be going through the courts any time now, and we haven't seen anyone. What we've seen is a lot of people detained without trial, detained for long periods of time, not being allowed to take their case to court. And that, to me, again, is very worrying. And that goes back to the point I tried to make, that they're creating a climate of fear, which then, in this climate of fear, people allow all sorts of things they wouldn't normally allow, these transgressions of personal freedoms. And we've got to be very wary of that, because a lot of our leaders love a crisis. Because a crisis to a psychopath is great news, because a crisis allows them to do all sorts of stuff that they wouldn't normally be allowed to do. So we need to be very careful about this use and manipulation I think we're experiencing of our fears. So in answer to your point, if there have been successes, then we should be seeing these people going through the courts, and I don't see them going through the courts. Okay, I don't dispute that point. However, let's go back to the psychological point I made about false alarms. If you have repeated false alarms, you've got repeatedly tanks on at Heathrow, and people say there's imminent threat of an attack, and then days go by, nothing happens, the tanks disappear. Psychologically, what's happening to us every time they give an alarm like that, and then nothing happens? The psychology theory says they should give some account of why they gave the alarm and then what happened. And they're not doing that. They're just giving alarm after alarm, then nothing happens. And after a while, several things happen. People become desensitized to the alarm in the first place. And after a while, they lose credibility. And that, so they're not, even if they've got good intelligence, they're just not handling it, I think, correctly. At least the psychology theory would suggest that some government minister should come on and give an account of why this alarm was given and why nothing happened. And they never do that. And I don't think that's wise, even from their standpoint. There was a question over there.
You used the word imagination in your talk. For individuals, I think it is very difficult to imagine the worst. It's not a very pleasant subject to think about. It's not a very easy to think about a future that is going to bring destruction. Perhaps perhaps another way of looking at it is to try to think, you know, what do we care about and how can we preserve what we care about and possibly maximize what we can care about? Would you care to mention on this?
Yes, but what do you think then that flows from that in terms of a different strategy?
Well, I think it opens the mind. It makes it more optimistic. I think that if you think about an adverse situation that is going to affect you, because obviously we always think in terms of an individual effect, we get stuck in a very narrow focus, and it's very difficult to move off the track.
I think that's an absolutely vital point, because we've been caught almost, something has happened which we've not become unaware of. We've been caught in cycles of negativity, which is the notion that we have to deal with these problems in a negative way by killing lots of people. What about approaching them in a more positive manner, which is sorting out some of the world's problems, some of the world's trouble spots, trying to fix the Palestinian-Israeli problem, trying to fix the problem in Sri Lanka? I mean, if America's willing to spend $160 billion on going to war in Iraq, if they spent just a small proportion of that and their power and leverage on fixing some of these problems, think what good they could do. And maybe if these problems were fixed, then maybe we wouldn't have the driving force of where millions of people in these communities think of this kind of terrorist action as their way of, often they frame it as defending themselves or trying to solve their problems. And it's very interesting that both Bush and Blair don't have this positive agenda. Again, at the Labour Party conference speech yesterday, Blair gave a personal assurance that he was going to put the Middle East and the Palestinian problem top of his agenda after November. Well, they've been saying that, you know, for well over a year. And why is it, again, as an electorate, I have to castigate you guys. As an electorate, we're not demanding that our leaders try and positively approach the world problems and positively sort them out, rather than going down this negative route of using a militaristic response each time.
Can I ask, have you considered that perhaps Blair and Bush also employ a psychiatrist to advise them in a different matter, in a different way of proceeding?
Which way is that?
I am not a psychiatrist.
Well, if they have employed one, can I first of all say that he's giving them very bad advice on the medication they're taking? because the dose really needs to be upped rather dramatically. The Americans actually do employ psychiatrists at the top end of leadership. And all American leaders since the war have had the benefit of psychiatric profiling of other world leaders. And I interviewed for my Radio 4 series Gerald Post, who was the psychiatrist at the CIA who was charged with profiling any of the world leaders that the then American president would have to meet. And they used these psychological profiles in their analyses of what's to be done. I tried to get Gerald Post to tell us what his psychiatric analysis of Margaret Thatcher was, but he wouldn't be drawn on that, unfortunately. I suspect at some level they are thinking to some extent, psychologically, about what's going on. What's interesting, though, is they're not carrying over that analysis in their public pronouncements, and they're not thinking, in terms of the public pronouncements, about the effect of terrorism on the psyche of the population. What I fear that they're doing is they're aware that it's having an effect, and they're using that effect to their own ends. That's the thing that's worrying, I think. Oh, I think we might be out of time.
Yes, so I'm Frank Cox. I'm a former professor of physics and former provost of this college. And whereas Barbara has the marvellous task of starting the proceedings, my duty always is to actually stop the discussion when it's getting interesting. And it's been very interesting indeed. Right, while I was listening to you, I was thinking of the story of the three doctors who went on a duck shoot, the GP, the psychiatrist, and the pathologist. And they went out quite happily. And the wildfowler told them in advance that some of the animals were protected and they couldn't shoot those, and there were the ducks. And suddenly an animal appeared, and the GP lifted up the gun, and the wildfowler said, "Are you sure?" And the GP said, "Looks like a duck, sounds like a duck, but I'd like a second opinion." And then the psychiatrist did the same thing, and the psychiatrist said, I'm pretty sure it's a duck, but does it know it's a duck? And then finally, the pathologist picked up his gun, blew two barrels, and said to the wildfowler, "See, that was a duck, would you?" I belong to the third category, and I learn more from dead people than I do from living people. But what you've actually shown us this evening is the mind of the duck. I think this is very, very important in this way here. You've told us, in fact, the way that people start ticking, and most of us are interested in what makes people tick wrongly or stop ticking altogether. And I'm absolutely certain that Sir Thomas Gresham, who set up this college over 400 years ago, to bring the new learning to the City of London, would have very much approved of what you've been talking about tonight. He was brought up in a time of Shakespeare, and madmen appear, inverted commas, appear throughout the whole of Shakespeare's works. And I think a lot of us have been rather indoctrinated by the fact that psychiatrists deal with people who are mad, who are what we would call mad, and without knowing what it actually means. And what you told us this evening is that your job is rather different from this. You're looking into the minds of anybody, and any one of us could be a patient of yours if we tried hard enough or wanted to be. Your lecture tonight was, in fact, very, very pertinent to what's going on at the present time. We had that magnificent drama on television a couple of nights ago. We had the hostage situation. And some of you don't know that the only helicopters that are allowed to come across this building as part of London are police helicopters. So the one going over was either looking for what you were saying or was looking for some terrorist who was hidden away. You've opened our minds up, as you intended to do. You've been very, very stimulating. And I think the whole of the audience will join with me in thanking you very much for one of the most exciting lectures we've had in this hall. Thank you, Raj.
For all information, please go to our website at www.gresham.ac.uk.